Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And if my voice sounds a little different or the recording not so pristine in studio quality, it's because I am recording this introduction remotely from a little vacation spot. In fact, you might hear some strange sounds in the background. And maybe I'll give a little off-camera care package away to anyone who can guess my location. Here's the hints. There are palm trees swaying, roosters crowing, there's a view of a bay, and it rains twice a day. So if you think you know where I am, send an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. And the first one who gets it right, I'll send a little off-camera care package out to. So we'll have a little Thanksgiving fun on this holiday. And as I was saying, in this episode, I sit down with director, writer, comedian, actor, and musician, Bo Burnham. Before YouTube became a ubiquitous and unavoidable black hole of viral cat videos, self-aggrandizing entertainment, and the source for some of the most incredible filmmaking on Earth, it used to be a place to share your homemade videos with family and friends. That's how the origin story of comedian, writer, and director Bo Burnham begins. It was 2006, and 16-year-old Bo, a lover of the performing arts, wanted to share his creations, musical bits, and jokes with his brother in college. But little did he know, his videos appealed to an audience that expanded far beyond his family and highlights what became his key to artistic success. As he says, the most interesting and complex thing you have to offer is what is personal to you, your subjective experience. Bo's interest in comedy grew as his audience expanded, and by the time he graduated high school, he decided to forego college and pursue a stand-up career, much to the initial dissatisfaction of his parents. With years of experience interacting with his internet audience, Bo found success rather quickly. By 2010, he released his first stand-up special, Words, 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 on Comedy Central, when he was in his early 20s, and followed that with two more specials, What and Make Happy, on Netflix, in the next few years. Bo recognizes that a large part of his success comes from his willingness to embrace change. As he says, I knew to take advantage of the fact that I wasn't going to be the same at 18 and 20 and 22, so my specials changed very rapidly because I was changing very rapidly. His shows are dynamic and include various theatrical elements like lighting and sound to create a stunning and unique experience. Bo's most recent project, Eighth Grade, is yet another example of his evolving artistic identity. The film, which he wrote and directed, follows the trials and tribulations of a 13-year-old girl living in the social media era. It's a realistic and compelling portrayal of the dissociative effects of social media. It's not an autobiography, but the themes and feelings behind the story are still very real for him. Bo still identifies with his anxious and awkward teenage self. As he tells it, my work is about presenting the things I'm struggling to understand rather than the things I've figured out. It's what you don't know that's interesting. Bo joins off camera to talk about the panic attack that led him to step down from stand-up, why it's so important for kids to be able to fail out loud, and why being miserable isn't a prerequisite for good art. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hi, Bo.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I discovered you through eighth grade. I wasn't someone that knew about your comedy specials. And then I went back and watched your specials. And it sort of confirms a theory I have about true artists. And that is that no matter what medium or form they go into, you can see a through line between all those iterations of their art. And I think that's the case, even though eighth grade is a film about, you know, it's to me a very disturbing and serious film about adolescence and puberty and social media and all seen through the eyes of this 13-year-old girl. But I see definite through lines to the themes that come across in your comedy specials as well. And even right back to early YouTube videos of you, you shine through in whatever you do.
Oh, that's very nice. You know, part of me feels like I'm trying with everything I do to like completely repudiate the thing I did before it. And then I do something and I realize like, oh,
I'm still me.
I'm just saying the same thing I am. And like, especially with eighth grade, I was really trying to like disappear for the first time. You know, I was really just trying to make work where I wasn't in it. But of course, I am in it in so many ways. I mean, just to literally get my face out of the way. I hopefully feel like I've maybe honed in on something. I do feel like I figured out the thing that I was maybe trying to say for a while. But yeah, it's probably in the same way life is. You know, the way you were yelling at your friends when you were, you know, 4 years old is the same way you, you know, yell at people in traffic when you're 28. I don't know. And I had this thought when I was young that, like, oh man, if like the really true great work is abstracted from the person making it, and it's just like some abstract thing of like, you know, it's like Mozart or Beethoven, like all those people. You think of great artistic genius as these people, you know, it's much more than autobiography. It's something abstract and perfect. And I don't think that's true. The older I've gotten, the less true I feel that that is. And the more I feel like my job is to present people with things I am struggling to understand rather than things I've figured out, which was what I was doing when I was younger. When I was younger, I was like, oh, I know what I'm going to do in my comedy. I'm going to tell people, like, God's not real, which is, like, cool 19-year-old. Like, congrats, you figured out God's not real. You really solved, you know, the problem that everyone's been thinking about for, you know, time eternal. So, yeah, that was a big realization for me, was to realize that, like, the thing that is personal to you is the deepest, most interesting, complex thing, which is the subjective experience.
Yeah.
Is there anything more mind-blowing than the subjective experience? That's where I'm at now. I mean, who knows?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm struggling with the fact that I have two girls in middle school right now. Mm. I have a sixth grader and a seventh grader.
Yeah.
And
oh, wow.
So your film scared the crap out of me. Mm. And I just wonder if there's something positive that you found about this this particular era we're in with social media, with how fast kids seem to be growing up. And
yeah, I mean, the true terror would be not acknowledging it and not seeing it. That would be the actual most dangerous thing that could happen. I do think I think the internet is not bad, or not even a majority bad at all. I mean, mostly what the internet's done, it's given visibility to people that have never had visibility and access to information to, you know, the entire world. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is like, these are very...
Well, I think that what happens for a parent is we wonder how to protect our kids.
Right,
and they can't make it... I worry that kids can't sort out all the information that they have access to.
Right, can we, though?
And we can't either, but at least
yeah.
We have... We've sort of
at least we have the nukes and everything. And that's, I mean, I don't know. There's no real at least to me, for me. Like, and I wasn't interested in particular in 13-year-olds because I was interested in the problems facing kids. You know, I felt like the kids for me were expressing the problems we're all facing just more viscerally than we were. Because I share all those concerns, and I can share those concerns for all of us. I mean, of course, there's an increased, like, vulnerability for their kids, and their minds are forming, and you do worry for their sake. But, like, I think we as adults, we need to clean up our own sort of information processing before we start to, you know, wag our fingers at what kids are doing about the internet and internet culture and these kids addicted to their phone. I'm like, what are we addicted to? How do we exchange information? We've completely set the culture on fire, I think, through the exact thing we're worried that kids might one day do. What are we worried? That these kids are going to be raised on their phones, have no way to communicate with each other, and then eventually, I don't know, elect a psycho to be... I mean, what are we talking about? We're there.
You know, like... Well, I think the difference is that when a kid gets on social media now, they're maintaining an audience and they're presenting a version of themselves. And I guess the difference is I can use social media without the number of likes directly affecting my self-esteem. Mm. And I have the experience to separate the two. But I do wonder, like, what you found about that audience that gets created, or that desire for, you know, your online life gets presented as something that you then have to live up to.
Yeah.
And the pressure of that.
The way that I made the film, like the way I had to think about the film for it to be resonant to me, is that, like, I couldn't arm's length it. So you may have that lived in experience that allows you to disassociate from whatever those, like, toxic effects of the internet are. I don't. So I feel like right in the mix with them. And the truth is, like, when I'm on the internet, when I was engaging with this stuff, I felt like a terrified, anxious 13-year-old kid. I felt like everyone in the culture was becoming that. And I felt like our country was being reduced to sort of 13-year-olds arguing with each other. So I was like, let's go to the source and just talk about it through them. And what I hope the movie sort of does, and what I think I hope all of my work was trying to sort of get at, which was to have a conversation about the internet and about social media, which, I mean, as a term is so fucking bogus. And like, social media, I mean, really think about that. Like, how are those words next to each other, let alone, you know, I mean, how, like, they shouldn't even be in the same paragraph. And they're like, social media, and that's something in our lives now, that like media is a personal,
like a branding
media.
Yeah.
Media, though, it's really fucked up. We're like not processing it. God, see, this is what happens when I get completely off track. But yeah, so I feel affected by it. And what my work I'm hoping try to do is try to give a more subjective, emotional description of what the internet is, not like a description of the internet as most people do, which is like the rates of cyberbullying are up and kids are spending 5 hours staring at a screen and they're getting headaches. And it's like, no. What is the feeling of, and you hinted at this, walking through your life and not just living your life, which is already hell and impossible, but taking inventory of your life, being a viewer to your own life, living an experience and at the same time hovering behind yourself and watching yourself live that experience, being nostalgic for moments that haven't happened yet, planning your future to look back on it. Those are really weird, strange, disassociative things that are, I think, new. And they are because of the specific structure of social media and the way it sort of disassociates ourself from ourself. I mean, this is now getting, I'm really at the edge of making sense because I don't have any of the answers here. But like, I don't know, it's really hard to process it. You know why? Because if you take long enough to think about it, these really complex social media, whatever setups that we have, take a long time to process. And by the time you process it and take the time, it is obsolete and it's on to the next thing.
So when you were writing this film, how did you kind of organize what you wanted to say, knowing that if you really think about it, it gets so meta that it gets impossible to think about it?
Well, I do not want my work to come from this place of like heady. I never want it to be intellectualized. I want it to be felt. So that was the hope of the film, is like, yes, we have all these conversations, but we're not trying to make a dissertation. I mean, these thoughts that I'm articulating are just articulations of feelings. I mean, these thoughts came from a subjective feeling of something. So that's what the movie's really trying to do.
You know, one of the scenes in the film that got me more than anything else, I think, is the scene in the car when Kayla is being driven home by a high school kid. Mm. And that has nothing to do with social media. That is as old as time, which is an older boy trying to use whatever powers he has in the moment, whether that's peer pressure or flattery or...
Yeah.
Trying to make
jokes.
The person feel cool, jokes, saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with this, you know, misdirection.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a big deal.
And
we're just joking. We're just having fun.
Yeah, and I think that scene is so disturbing because it does highlight how the gauntlet that every kid, girls, women especially, have to go through, finding out that humans do not represent themselves fairly and honestly when they want something. Mm. You know what I mean? That scene to me was scary because I think I'd never seen a scene in a movie done that well that focuses on the nuance of how we are manipulated as people. And maybe that does wink back at social media because it is a manipulation, but that's the human version of it or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Social media is only just a different degree or an abstraction of those regular behaviors.
It's an amplifier.
There's no new thing. It's just like, you know, kids always cared what they looked like, always cared how they presented themselves, always cared how they were received. But yes, no, but that's interesting. I never thought of that, but I think that is right. Attention, I think, is also kind of like, a bit like the currency of the movie, when you give your attention, when you get it, what it means. You know, she like is never paying attention to her father. You know, people just in scenes, it's all about kind of just wanting some type of attention.
Yeah.
And then what happens when that attention is wanted or unwanted or, but yeah, that scene was also just, it's doing what a lot of the movie's trying to do, which is trying to portray an experience that may, when described after the fact, not sound like a big deal, but when it is
yeah, exactly.
felt in the moment, it's incredibly significant.
Well, what was your process for making sure you got the world right of that age and that time? Because one of the greatest things about the film is that it seemed to be embraced by the ages of the kids that were depicted.
Yeah, some, you know, it's like some of them. I don't know. Like, if I was in eighth grade and there was a movie called Eighth Grade, I'd be like,
You wouldn't trust it. Yeah.
I'd be like, yeah, all right, back off, you know? Like, I get that. And our impulse, like, I was not trying to make a movie for eighth graders. You know what I mean? I didn't care. You know what I mean? Because I think kids are underserved, ironically, by material that is made for them. They deserve to have material made about them, you know, without worrying whether they'll like it or not. Which is the respect we give to adults, you know. No one's going like, I hope cowboys like this cowboy movie, you know what I mean? They just make a cowboy movie. but yeah, the way we went about it, you know, and the impulse for the script really was, you know, her videos, which were watching videos of young kids speaking online. And, you know, these videos of, you know, kids giving a 10-minute monologue straight down the barrel of a lens, you know, talking about, you know, okay, middle school advice number 54, and they're just giving a 10-minute video, you know. The way these kids spoke and presented themselves, it was in such sharp contrast to the way I had seen teens speak in media, which was teens in movies and television tend to speak like young poet laureates. They tend to speak suspiciously similar to a screenwriter's ability to write.
A 40-year-old white guy.
Yeah, exactly. Just being like, well, I'm going to tell you about how I went from being the queen of the school to the ba-da-ba-da, ba-da-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. And it's like, nah, like, and when you saw these videos, you saw kids that were trying so hard to sound like that. You saw that, like, these kids were trying to present themselves honestly, but what they were actually doing was imitating the characters they'd seen in movies. Yet they were completely failing. They were being completely inarticulate. And somehow these videos were, all at the same time, they were, like, personal and generic. They were very honest and yet completely performed. They were guarded and open. And I just thought, like, if this were a performance in a movie, this would be incredible. And the process that I'm watching of these kids having to navigate, like, this weird performed version of themselves as confession is, to me, real life and is, to me, way more honest than our private moments. To me, like, the truth of the current moment is how you choose to perform honesty, not how you are in your private moment, not your diary.
That's so weird.
I think our deepest truths are like public performances. I really do.
So you're saying that it's what we reveal by the way we choose to present it.
Exactly. That to me is so much more vulnerable than the thing we scribble in our diary. Which, go read your diary. It's a performance too. You're performing to yourself. Read your diary. You'll read your diary and go like, why am I trying to sound deep to myself? You know what I mean?
It's right. Fun.
And that's where you realize, like, oh, the performance goes all the way down.
No, but
this, I mean, who are we kidding? You know what
sure.
I mean? But that's what's so funny. Like, this, I mean, I'm very aware of how I'm sounding right now. I'm very aware of how I'm presenting myself. I'm trying my best to be honest, but I'm also trying to be articulate and not pretentious. Humble and not dead-eyed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm saying that, like, we can actually unironically say that this is a pretty candid, naturalistic conversation, even though our cameras are here, because we're in 2018, and when are there not cameras around? You know,
right.
When are we not?
Well, there is that argument that when it becomes ubiquitous, then it becomes something you forget about. But to your point, it's always a performance as well. But I imagine, you know, someone who went on a date in the 30s is performing throughout dinner.
Exactly.
And a version of doing this.
Yes, and in the 1500s, babies didn't come out being like people were taught to be like, oh, my liege. Like, they didn't want to do that. You know what I mean? They were like doing that to fit in.
Right.
So it's like, it's a great point. Like, social media might just be like pointing at the elephant that's always been there, or just giving the mouse in the room a little, you know, some chemical that turns it into an elephant and goes like, oh, that thing has been here the whole time. It was just so subterranean we couldn't really notice it. That metaphor was stretched way beyond its use.
Yeah, it was.
But, I mean, chemicals, mice, elephants. But, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, it's always been there. You're right. And it's true that, like, not only the particulars of social media, like bullying and self-perception, that, but the performative aspect has always been there. It's just never been concretized like this. Like, it's like, and it's just never been so goddamn shameless.
Yeah.
It's weird.
True. That's the other thing. I mean, that's the odd thing is that I would think there'd be some embarrassment associated with it. I was at a Dodger game this year, and these two girls showed up, and they had their branded large drinks with the fancy straw mechanism. And and before they even drank them or looked at the game, they both got their phones out, and they shot pictures of the drinks and had to figure out a funny caption. And I'm watching them going, oh, this looks like I'm watching someone at work. Like they're working. And there's no shame about it. There's no, like, you know, it's, I don't even want to.
No, but the sicker version of it is, which I see, is the cool, bohemian, hip, ironic people who go to a Dodgers game and hold up a Bud Light can in front of it and say they're at the Dodgers game, and they think they're riffing off of the shallow people by pretending to be shallow and performing a fake, ironic version of being shallow. Fuck you. Like, that makes me go crazy. Like, it's not enough to be like, I'm an asshole. It's like, stop being an asshole.
Yeah.
Just stop.
Right.
You know what I mean? I can't tell the difference between, we're all like so irony literate. You know what I mean? We're just all so, yeah, that it confuses me.
I can't tell if this is like the last stage before we've peeled back all the layers, or if this is chaos theory and we're nearing the end.
Yeah, yeah, maybe it is. But I see more, and it might just be, you know, the problem is we all have like feed blindness too, because all of our timelines are specifically just, you know, reflecting the people around us. But I see more people ironically making fun of internet shallowness than I actually see internet shallowness. And to me, the real shallowness is people that think they're above things and can make fun of it and have it at the same time. Oh, it's so confusing.
I guess the question would be, when do you feel real and like you're not putting a performance on?
With my dog.
With your dog?
Mm-hmm.
You don't think you're performing a little bit for the dog?
I definitely am performing for my dog. I mean, but like, it's, you really are truly performing for the dog to make him feel better or to make him...
It's earnest.
It's humble. It's not to be seen.
So when you...
He might not even be conscious. I mean, I don't even know how sentient these things are. I don't even know, like, do they even have thoughts? But it's like, I'm just there and I'm present. And it's gettable. That's the other thing. I'm not someone that's sitting back going, this is all bullshit, fuck this. Like, I see pieces of art and culture and things and people that bowl me over all the time, and I strive for that stuff. And it's just, you know, you can be aware of the landmines without throwing the whole game out, you know, so...
Yeah. Well, when you started making this film and you went back to film at high schools and everything, did you find that there was more of you in the film than you thought there was?
Yeah, it was interesting because I had thought, you know, in writing it, like, I was mostly just writing about my current self, you know what I mean, through this kid. But then when you, like, show up to a middle school and you, like, smell the hallway or smell, like, the art classroom, it's just like, woo, like, it really is like... You just start sweating and you're like immediately back there. Yeah, I didn't love pool parties. I think those were very, very traumatic for me. So
yeah, me too.
I definitely put that in there for that reason. But again, I see my current self in the movie the most, but maybe that's because I see my eighth grade self in my current self.
Right.
So, but it could be both of those. I don't know. But it's interesting. And a huge part of my career also has been, career, whatever it is like, I started when I was 16. You know what I mean? And like, look back at the stuff you were making when you were 16. Let alone look back at the 2006-7 comedy when you're making offensive, edgy humor that does not hold up, you know, 11 years later. So part of the movie was like going back and like forgiving myself a little bit in a way.
Oh, that's interesting. Sort of like, yeah, because I think you were the first generation of person that was able to not only archive, but also transmit your earliest attempts at art.
Really, the truth is, like, when I put the stuff on the internet the first time, I didn't know they were there. There was no actual model for YouTube being a place where you went viral. I was like kind of just showing my brother in college. So I didn't quite know what that was.
But it was a free way to upload a video.
Yeah, it kind of, no, literally, I was like, I want to show my brother in college, my brother's in college, I didn't want to show him the song I wrote. My friend was like, oh, like, you should upload to this thing called YouTube. And it just happened to be that, like, the video didn't have, like, hey, Pete, but it didn't. And so I was like, hey, guys, how you doing? Like, I was like, just in case anyone else saw it. But no, I mean, I still had in mind wanting to see it with other people and show it to other people. But yeah, it's, I'm happy to be an example of someone. I have offensive things that I'm not, I'm very proud of being able to be here, and every video I posted allowed me to be here, and I wouldn't touch a single thing because of the butterfly effect. I wouldn't be able to be here, but I'm very grateful to, you know, all the moments led to this moment. But it's embarrassing. Some of them are embarrassing. Some of them are, you know, 2006, 16-year-old trying to be edgy. It's kind of a little homophobic. It's literally racially insensitive. And I'm happy to be an example of someone that failed out loud publicly in a certain way and was hopefully able to evolve and get past that. And I do worry that kids don't have that freedom anymore. They don't have the freedom to fail out loud, because a huge part of being anything, not just being creative, is failing and trying things and feeling in the dark and going, oh, that's a wall. Okay, I don't go past there. You know, but like, and there are some stoves on. You know what I mean? I'm just stretching metaphors left and
no,
right.
No, I get it.
But you get the, you know, it's
you get
like,
burned.
It's like, you're going to fuck up. You're going to say some wrong shit, and you have to be able to atone for that. If you're a kid, you have to be given the...
The fear of seeing entire lives wiped out because a mistake is revealed.
Yeah, especially if it's a kid, a 17-year-old. You know what I mean? Like, that's the other thing, though, about the current moment that's so difficult. But is correct, probably. How many caveats you have to make, how many subordinate clauses you need to make before you actually say your statement. But it's probably right.
I can't imagine. It's like the landmines for a kid to reaching their goal or what they think is their goal while being watched and scrutinized the whole time.
Right, and beyond just the scrutiny, beyond just the like, okay, I fucked up because I said something wrong and I got in trouble. The awareness that kids have, and I try to talk to this about young kids that are getting into creative stuff, it's like they're aware way too much of the entire process before they've even started. They are working on their own ability to self-brand before they have anything to sell. And I try to tell kids all the time, like, the best promotion is being good at something. So just get good at something before you figure out how to sell the thing you're good at. But also, this is affecting me creatively, is like the entire creative process, it feels like, has sort of collapse to a single point. And now when you go out to write something, you're immediately thinking about how it'll be received in the current culture. You're immediately maybe make a little tweet of the idea and put it out and just take a little temperature of how this thing's being received. You're immediately getting feedback on your idea and adjusting your idea. And I don't think that's a natural place for the creative process to live. I think you're supposed to kind of retreat, work for a while, disappear, and then present something. And that's very, very, very hard to do now. Very hard for a lot of reasons.
What was the impetus performing initially for you? Like, what was it that you wanted to do?
I wanted to act in theater for a long time, and then I had a feeling I wanted to do comedy. And then freshman year of high school, I sort of started teaching myself piano because I had never played an instrument, and I really am not naturally musically gifted at all. I was always pretty good at math and things, so I come at music way more from a left brain side, and I'm really, really jealous of natural musicians, and when I come across them, there's a big difference between them and me. So I think my music, you know, I try to improve, but my music was really just sort of, I think, holding the ideas I was always trying to make.
Was it ever like, I would like to make a serious record, or was it always like, oh, I can express something humorous or philosophical through music?
No, I just enjoyed it. I don't know, I just enjoyed it. I think about the times I maybe thought something like that, and I feel like my creative process has been, the less I think about things, like, the less I kind of curate my, the more I just kind of do what I feel like I want to do. I don't know why that felt like something I needed to dodge. Sometimes I feel like I want to be serious in music. I have a deep, feel like a completely fraudulent musician. I feel like a pretty good writer. I feel like a pretty good writer and a decent performer and a fake musician.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
That's
definitely,
interesting.
Definitely.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because music is such a big part of your performing persona.
Mm, mm.
Well, when you started sort of writing songs, I was curious about your parents' perspective on that. And I think that when a parent has a really original kid, it's probably quite scary initially, because it doesn't look like what the rest of the kids are doing. I was just curious what your parents' initial reaction was, because YouTube was so new, and then when all the views started pouring in, I'm sure for parents, they were like, what does this mean?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Yeah, it's very weird. And like 250,000 kids or people are looking at your kid. I'd be like, what? I would be right. Like, no. Like,
was there ever a discussion about that of like...
Yeah, I had a couple of videos that I had to take down for a good reason.
The naked ones?
Yeah. I mean, almost. It's like, they'd be better off. It was, it's just... Yeah, I can't imagine. We talked about this recently, my mother and I.
Oh, yeah?
It was like far enough away where I'm not like... I was so embarrassed of it for a while because it felt so close to me, and now it's 10 years ago or 11 years ago, and I can kind of actually see it as this other part of myself that I can smile at. And I asked her about it, and she was like, yeah, I think it upset her at first, but now she carries all this guilt because, like, it was your dream and I didn't support you. And I'm like, you did. For 2 weeks, you were like, maybe delete the video where you're talking about fetuses, you idiot. And I like did, like, cause I was 16. I'm like, mom, I'm glad you made me do that. Like, I can't believe you let me get away with murder. I mean, in posting that stuff, but they trusted me. They
did
trust me. And that's what shocked my mother, is I was a very well-behaved kid. I was just sort of did my schoolwork and stayed at home. So, like, this, like, video stuff was like, whoa. Like, I wasn't the class clown.
You weren't?
Not in the class clownish way. I feel like the class clown is just, like, the kid in the back being like, pussy, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't love that kid.
Well, so I had a really hard time at high school because I matured really late. I didn't think I had hair under my arms until college or something.
Me too. Okay. I had to take testosterone shots to hit puberty. This is me stunted. This is stunted growth for me. I was supposed to be 6'10".
Really?
And they had to give testosterone shots to boost, to start puberty for me when I was sophomore year. And that's all. That's a lot of me, I feel like, was that shame. So I'm sorry to cut you off, but I share it.
No, I think that, you know, making this film, I'm sure, brought up how you saw yourself. Like, you becoming a comedian and so much of your show is this meta, turn myself inside out, answer all these questions about self-identity and try to be authentic thing that's happening in your shows. I wonder if that source started in high school where you were dealing with a self-identity that was really a product of your maturity at the time and puberty and all of that stuff.
That's interesting. You're selling myself better than I probably am. I'm saying you're giving me a better out than I am, which is like, yeah, the meta's like... The also source of this stuff, if I'm being honest with myself, is like I was a pretentious little dick that just loved to talk and loved to think. Like, I love to think out loud, and like, I'm sure that's come across at least a little bit.
But that's probably somewhat needing attention and needing to know that you're okay too.
Yes, and just like that's maybe my first taste of
an audience.
When I was young, feeling like, oh, I'm smart. And I can think about things. So there's that. I mean, the thing that it made me think about when you were saying that was like trying to run away from my image of being a 16-year-old kid on the internet. And I think that's probably right in some degree. But I feel fortunate that I knew to take advantage of this, which is like my kind of creative life was from 16 to 26. And I knew even at 16, even though I had an audience, like I felt like, well, I'm not going to be the same when I'm 18 and 20 and 22 and 24. So my specials and my things changed very rapidly because I was changing very rapidly. And I tell young people to do that, like take advantage of how chaotic you are, how changing you are, how much of a hypocrite you are, that you will think the exact opposite thing in a year. Listen to that. Don't worry about building some like coherent oeuvre. That's the stuff I've let go of.
Were you in high school, were you that person like Kayla, like kind of mortified?
No.
You weren't?
I wasn't, no. I didn't start having panic attacks and things until I was 23, you know, and my first one on stage in front of 2,000 people. I was a nervous-ish kid, but I was more confident than her. I was outgoing, I had friends. It was adulthood and that really sort of slammed me like that, so.
Really?
Yeah, I really do see her as like an equal. Like, oh, you are dealing with the things at fucking 13 that I'm dealing with at 25, and you're dealing with it slightly better than me.
Okay, so talk about that, because you do this this bit where you separate your life, your left brain and your right brain. It's this incredible piece of performance. First off, because every time you're being your right brain, you're bathed in red light, and every time you're being your left brain, you're in cool blue light. And immediately the audience gets it that you're having this dialogue yeah. between the two halves of your brain, and they're fighting for dominance. And in the end, you come up with this solution that comedy is going to save you.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I was curious about if there was a moment, and if you remember the moment where you're like, oh, comedy is the thing I should be doing. It's the thing that reconciles whatever is, you know, whoever I am.
Well, it's interesting. It's like, and that bit was really like, I saw David Hasselhoff, a performance of him doing Jekyll and Hyde, the musical. I saw it online, and it's him being like, come on, Jekyll, I won't do that. And it's all these light switches, and it was just beautiful.
I love that David Hasselhoff is the influence.
It really was. It really was. I'll take for anywhere. But yeah, it's interesting, like, there was, I liked making a show. You know what I mean? I really liked building a show. So sometimes I attended to the themes of the show, and the themes of the show weren't necessarily the themes of my life. Like, is it 100% true that comedy saved me? It's a thing I should be doing? Maybe. Is it cool for the guy on stage to affirm the exact thing he's doing at the end of the bit? That he's maybe that worked, so I didn't really care about you know like
sure.
There was for at least a while, it was like I love theater, like that was my first love, really, and that's what I thought of my shows as. And even though my stand-up shows were me talking about me with things I wrote, I just felt I just wanted to put on a good show that was powerful and made sense and hopefully revealed some truths and was vulnerable and sad, but also just vulnerable and sad sometimes so you wouldn't know when it would be funny. Then
right.
It was really surprising, you know, because I realized, like, so much of comedy is about getting the audience off guard. And if they know you're funny the whole time, you're never gonna really get them off guard because they know something funny's coming. So I realized if I start getting a little sad or serious or scary or whatever, people really have no idea what's coming.
Well, that's the thing about your shows, is that there's a misdirection there that that happens in all different forms to great effect. And for people who haven't seen it, I mean, sometimes you're at the piano singing, sometimes you're speaking to a disembodied voiceover that is antagonizing you. Sometimes you're sort of the puppet master making sounds happen and sometimes the audience can feel like they're at a concert, and sometimes they can feel like they're at therapy. And I was curious if you knew.
I like that. Those are good two sides. The opposite of therapy really is a concert.
But that, I mean, people. There is this scope.
It's
hard to understand until you've seen it how much you've broken the form of what a stand-up special can be.
And yeah, well, that's really nice. And, like, all of me wants to take credit for all of that. Like, but the truth is, like, there's a lot of, they're just not in the States, really, but there are a lot of European and Australian comedians that really do push the form, and those are people that I found, and, well, Steve Martin in the 70s really did do
like
a lot.
Like the time he took his audience to McDonald's.
Yes, yeah, exactly, and just like props and music and lights and gags. But yes, I wanted to do theater. I mean, that's what I wanted to do, and I remember getting into stand-up, and then I was like, all right, I guess I'm doing stand-up, and I was trying to wrestle all the things I loved about theater into that form just because I was bored. And like the disembodied voices you're talking about, that was just because I was doing stand-up going like, I'm not listening on stage anymore. When I did theater, I used to listen. I used to be, and I really enjoyed that, like listening, not just talking the whole time. So the voices just allowed me to sit up there and listen. But that was the impulse, was just to try to make... I remember going to a show of a very famous comedian that we don't talk about anymore when in like 2008, 9, 10 or something like that. It was a 3,000-seat theater in Boston. And the comedian was just this tall in a little spotlight, and I'm in the back. And I'm going like, what the fuck is this? Like, I should just be listening to this on a CD or something. Which, I'm not bashing that. I love the pure art form of stand-up, stripped down. I just can't do it. But I thought, like, if I can ever get to a point where I can play theaters, I'm going to use this space. I'm going to use, look at all these, look at that rig up there. I mean, look at this thing. Like, this place could be bumping. And right. You can do something you can't do with a concert, because, like, a concert, you're all screaming and yelling, you all know the words, but you know, it's theater. It really is theater.
Right. But no, yeah. It's true. You have sort of taken why people want to go and see a show. Mm. Like, oh, we're going to see some stuff, you know? And then you mix in like this really personal, vulnerable, meta stand-up routine and you put it in there. And it is something new. And I was curious about your process. Like, take me through your process of when you get a germ of an idea, how do you sort of put it through your steps of what it eventually becomes?
It's interesting. And for context, I should say, and I'm starting to dip back in now a little bit, but like I quit for 2 years.
Yeah, I want to talk about
that too. Doing it. So I'm just now trying to find my process again a little bit. It's weird. I don't write anything. For stand-up, for some reason, I can't write anything down. It doesn't help me. It helps me to just do it in my head. You know, it used to be when I started out, a lot of my like songs and bits were just like kind of one-liners crammed together, or like some like concept to hold jokes. Like it was like songs like Ironic, and it's like it's a song about things being ironic, you know. And then it was sort of a late realization, which is way too late for a musical comedian, which is like, oh, no, the music should be the concept. It should be funnier. The music should make it funnier. So the concept should lead rather than the joke. But like, I mean, yeah, like I went to see Kanye's concert and saw this bit that I thought was incredible where he gave this like speech in the middle of, and the theatricality of Kanye's live shows, I mean, regardless of what the fuck is going on right now, the way he integrates theater into his live shows, I think is absolutely genius. But I was going about being like, oh, there's a definite funny version of that. So sometimes it is just like, for lack of a, you know, deeper word, spoof of something that's already there with my own feel of it.
And then when you hit on something, because your show is precise, like, how do you start rehearsing that?
Doing it. Because every other special that I'd seen were it's basically hours of material that are worked out in clubs 15 minutes at a time or whatever. And then for the special, they put all these lights up and they do the special, you know? And I was like, I want to do a show that you can't practice in a club. It makes no sense in a club. The whole meaning of the show is that it's in front of 1,200 people and it's on this sort of scale. That I really wanted the technical aspect of the show and the material to be one and the same and inseparable.
So when you get it precise and it's working and you know all the cues, because I feel like with a lot of stand-up comedians, the whole artifice is about making it feel off the cuff spontaneous.
Yeah.
But you don't have that.
Yeah, no.
Clearly, you play with the audience's idea of that.
Yeah,
you do
yeah.
a thing once where you knock over the water, and then you apologize, and then the voiceover says he meant to knock over the water.
Yeah, yeah.
And you realize you're watching something that's completely manipulating the audience and acknowledging the manipulation.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm curious if, when you know a show that well, because you have to, because the cues, do you have that thing that happens where you're having other thoughts entirely while on stage performing?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how the panic attack started. But yeah, I mean, part of, to answer the first part is like, everyone says like, be honest on stage. And I'm like, all right, well, if I'm being honest on stage, I'm not gonna be like, I gotta tell you, I'm not great at laundry. Like, I'd get up and be like, I'm fucking up here, you're all staring at me. What is this? Like, what is this room? You paid $40, the amount of money you're paying me is actually actively making me not be able to relate to you on a deep level. Like there's that paradox. There's so much. I'm just saying, there's so much to get past him before I can be honest about my day, you know? So it was my version of honest sort of confessional comedy. It was me going up and going, I'm lying, I've done this before. But hopefully making it, it's also, I think, funny to do those things, but to say, yeah, I know exactly when you're gonna laugh. This is, you know, you think you're unique, Sacramento laughed at the exact thing you did, you got tricked, you know, whatever. It's just funny. It's also funny. It's also kind of like something like a little trickstery to do. That's fun.
You're
that's
right.
fun.
And it's that like is punk. More honest.
Yeah, it is. And to me, it was going like, yeah, rather than being like, oh, kicking the dirt and, you know, bringing out my tattered notebook and going like, yeah, I just thought of something, you know. But that's also just not my style. But yeah, like, yes, when you know a show that well and it's that rigid and you do it that many times, you can just lift off yourself.
Right.
And then sometimes those thoughts can become, hey, freak out now. Why not just freak out?
And so then what happens?
Well, sometimes it's just, you know, you're just cruising around thinking of something else. It's also lazy and you shouldn't, you know what I mean? Like if you're correct, there's more to see in it. And if there isn't more to see in it, you should write better material. You know, you should be able to lose yourself in it. But it's hard. It's hard. It's a hard thing as a performer. But yeah, I would. I mean, the thing of panic attacks was just sort of just like an axe that was just sort of swinging over my head that would drop it, you know, once in a while.
So tell me about the first time that happened.
The Edinburgh Fringe Festival. I was my opening night. I was in front of a lot of people performing, and 10 minutes in, just zoom, tunnel vision and shortness of breath, and I had no idea what it was. I just powered through it for 10 minutes. No one knew it was happening. And I was like, that was weird. And I didn't realize, and then...
So you didn't know it was a panic attack?
I didn't know.
Even afterwards?
No, I didn't have the words for it. I didn't really have that frame of reference. Because it's also hard to really come to terms with a panic attack when you're, like, doing something ridiculous.
Right.
You're like, you know, I've had 10 panic attacks in my life, 9 on stage. Oh, one my God. On a train between shows. You know, so it's always been linked to this. You know, be Googling and do like this, like the comical dark shit of like, like Googling between shows, like how to deal with stage fright. And people going like, don't worry, like when you get up to talk in front of your class doesn't even care that you're talking. And I'm like, nah, it doesn't
Picture
apply
them
to
in
me.
Their underwear.
I'm going like, no, they do care. It's like 3,500 people in San Francisco and they've all paid money to see me. Like, this isn't.
And then, so what do you grasp onto when that happens?
The earth, metaphorically, the grass, and try not to fall off the earth, yeah. I would just power through it.
And
just
you could still remember what you were supposed to do, and... Like, yeah. Did you ever have a thing where you just lost your way entirely, and...
Sure.
So what do you do then?
You fail, and you fucking fall on your face, and you suck, and you feel pain, and embarrassment, and shame. And endure it, and then you go, I'm still here, maybe. Do I want to do that again? Do I want to be in the position where I want to do that again? And for me, it was no, and I stopped doing it for 2 years because of that reason.
So you, when you were about to go on stage, once you knew what was happening, were you like, this could be the night I have a panic attack?
Yeah, always, every single night, it was that. What happened is I had 3 panic attacks in 4 shows to start off a 60-show tour in 2 months. And that was the worst time of my life. And I would have my stage manager, he would just, before I would go on stage, he would slap me in the back. I would just ask him just slap me in the back as hard as he could. Because I was just like numb in the hands and was just, this is like a self-pity thing. To come to terms with your anxiety on the road, you know what I mean, in front of thousands of people a night, very, very abstract. Not only that, to come to terms with it, while also performing a show that is meta-criticizing yourself in real time as a performer in front of the thing. It's like, it was like, at a certain point, it was just ridiculous. But it was during that I made the bit, which I was like, all right, I'll talk about it. I'm going to talk about the fact, like, I'm going to talk about the climactic finale ending to my show is going to be a big song about how I can't do this, and I'm really scared of this. But it's also going to be, in theory, the biggest, best version of a spectacle I've ever done. You know what I mean? Which I think it was for me. It was my best version of that. I feel better about it now. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm less scared of going up there and failing than I ever was. And the movie really, really helped that. When I went up with just my stand-up show, I felt like every day I'm risking my entire career. I'm risking everything I've ever worked for. And just one show's going to fuck up. I'm going to panic. They're going to take a video of it, and I'm over. I don't feel that way anymore.
Wow.
The movie didn't need to be a success or anything for me to feel saved by it. I felt saved by the process of making it. It's also getting older, too. You know what I mean? People told me that. You know what I mean? That, like, part of my panic and my anxiety is particularly young. You know, I need love and attention and anything that isn't... and this is the honest stuff I have to admit, you know, it's like, my anxiety might have been, like, literally hinging on the fact of I need a standing ovation every night. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, it could be that... I had to look at myself and go, am I this fragile? Am I this fragile? Do I require this much adoration? And that's probably indicative of my generation too. But I'm happy to be the sort of pathetic, you know, hyperventilating example.
You know what? I don't find it pathetic at all. I think that to have all that happen and to do it very publicly has to have some consequences.
Right. But for me, because it's the truth, is that it's not unique. And it's not because I'm a special little boy and I'm the most special boy that ever was. And because that's the belief that a lot of people have. And a lot of people with anxiety, I think, have. So they cling on to it and go, like, actually, the reason I know. Or similar, I think depression can have a similar thing to it sometimes, which is, I have this because I see the world. It is part of my depth. It is part of what makes me intelligent. And that's wrong. And that was part of the movie, too, was going, like, I talked about my anxiety on stage as particular to my circumstance, going, I feel this way about my life because I'm a 23-year-old at the time, you know, comedian with an audience having to perform my life in real time. And a bunch of 14 and 15-year-old girls came up to me afterwards and said, I feel exactly like you. And they weren't 23-year-old comedians.
They were filling a theater.
Yeah,
they were
exactly.
Just going to school.
And that was a huge realization for me. So I went, like, I told our story with my circumstance. Now let's tell our story with your circumstance. And I do deeply believe it's the same story. I don't believe that my anxiety is special at all.
Now that's a great way to put it. Although I have to ask, you know, writing something like this and then going out and being a first-time director, I would think that could potentially be a fairly high percentage anxiety producing situation as well. And I wondered if you experienced any of that or...
I felt like, sure, anxiety, but like, you know, the feeling of anxiety where it's right beside excitement and it's right beside stress and it's almost indistinguishable from it. And no, I never, ever felt the panic ever I felt on stage. Because that was, I recognize and I thrive off of a certain type of anxiousness and nervousness. I want that. I crave that feeling.
Did that experience, that excitement, stress, anticipation feeling on the film make you think your gut was telling you this is what you are supposed to be doing and maybe not going on stage?
Yeah, well, I feel like I could do, I mean, the issue with having a passion for making movies is your passion requires hundreds of people and millions of dollars, which is a silly passion to have. but it is the thing I felt like I can see myself wanting to do this for the rest of my life. I can see, like, stand-up is like an old lover that I'm sure I'll get back together.
With little booty call.
What the fuck am I doing? You know what I mean? Then we'll be like 2 months into it, and I'll be like,
exactly.
I knew she was like it.
I know why I broke up with you now. I remember.
Yeah, yeah. There's something there.
Well, so when you abandoned it, it wasn't that, oh, I'm going to go off and make a film. It became too painful to continue.
It was 50% enjoyment and 50% hell, and it just, like, I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. And at a certain point in this sort of industry, there's the idea of, and it's probably in a lot of industries, is like, if opportunities are available to you, you have to take them. Like, after I did Make Happy, like, you know, I could have sold more tickets than I'd ever had or whatever. And, like, you're supposed to always sort of just take that.
Right.
But I felt before I even did it, this will be my last one.
Well, it's funny. I think that you're sort of affirming my thoughts about what it is to try to live the life of an artist, is that you can't just do something because now you can fill theaters and now you can reap the benefits. I think the thing that's so hard to reconcile is that it's hard to turn down opportunities when they are so much bigger than you ever imagined your dreams would come to.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And
of
you
course.
Go, like, how could I abandon this? This is what I've always wanted.
Right, and it seems like, and it feels like so beyond privileged issues, but, you know what I mean, to me, what are you talking about? But there must.
But it's your life.
But
and
there's
it's
some
specific to you.
And there, I'm sure there are comparable things for anyone in their life, which is like, what did you want? What? Why did you? At a certain point, you completely lose track over what you wanted. And I was like, what am I talking about? I'm lucky enough to have food on the table and a roof over my head. What do I? I don't need anything else. Can I start enjoying this now? You know, I feel like I'm, like, why was I trying to build a career? But also, just to let go of the, and this is something I think we all have to do. No, again, well, I think something we all have to do is stop speaking for everybody like I just did. You know what I mean? That's my issue. It's like, I try to speak in the first person and not anything else, because I hate when people speak about, you know, what you have to do is, you know, we have to, it's like, shut up, what the fuck do you know? You know what I mean? You're just a head in a fucking body, too. but for me, it was very important that I stopped thinking about myself as a capital, as a proper noun, and as this career to maintain. And there's some people that can do it really elegantly. There's some people, I don't think they're happy, though. And that's kind of the name of the game creatively right now, which is a real bummer. If you want to be get into the arts as a young person, you want to be creative, you want to just kind of be this character, right? This, like, character. I'm seeing a lot less art and a lot more characters.
Yeah.
It also feels like the promotional tours for movies are like, those are the actual main characters of the art we consume, or like, are the people that celebrities are on the talk shows. It feels like people just do movies just as an excuse to be able to live the proper noun character of themselves in the sort of public arena. And that's a bummer.
No, you say in one of your shows that you compare a comedian to a sociopath in terms of what kind of brain does it take to be able to make a whole audience laugh at really sad things, or, you know, the example you were giving. And I mean, sitting here talking to you, I realize that
I'm a sociopath.
You're a sociopath.
Yeah.
No, I think to be able to make the sort of connections and realizations that make an entire audience, you can surprise them, you can make them see themselves better, you can give someone a different perspective, you know, that requires a sort of a different kind of brain. And sitting here talking to you, I feel like you have that. And all the things you're talking about, boy, if you could shut off part of your brain and just enjoy it, it would probably be really easy, but it would never fulfill you.
I increasingly more and more really respect happy people and content people. I really do. I think it's very, very intelligent.
Well, this is exactly the stuff you have to go through to be able to make art that moves people. You know what I mean? Mm. You have to ask these questions. You probably have to have those panic attacks. You have to have stage fright. You have to want to abandon something, and that has to be the catalyst to go try to do something different. Because if you don't, then, like, have you ever met a comfortable person in their 20s that yeah. has anything to say?
Yeah, and it's probably just like the antibodies of my mind just conjuring problems for me, because I have had such a fortunate life. I really have. I've had such a fortunate life that I needed some sort of obstacles to overcome. And those are the things I, like, secretly wanted in, you know, my youth.
Yeah.
Just looking at, like, my, you know, my happy middle-class parents and being like, duh, give me something to rebel against, you know? And then my mind was like, whew, you know? I just,
Well, it's fascinating talking to you. And I'm really impressed with what you are able to say in eighth grade and what you're able to do with the form of comedy in your specials. I know that whatever you do next is going to be really interesting and unexpected. And
I appreciate it.
Thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks. And I appreciate the time.
Talking.
It was very, very wonderful to talk to you. And I've enjoyed this show, and I enjoy your work. It's like, I'm very honored to be here.
Thank you. Well, I'm honored to have you.
Appreciate it.
Hey folks, that's our show. If you haven't yet seen 8th Grade, go check this film out immediately. It is an absorptive and terrifying experience if you're a father, but also an incredibly realistic portrayal of the gauntlet we all run in adolescence and how that gauntlet has been amplified and changed in 2018 with social media. You can also check out Bo's Netflix specials, Make Happy and What, on Netflix. And I guarantee you've never seen a comedy special like this. It is completely engaging, and all the more astounding when you realize how young Bo was when he conceived these shows. I, for one, hope he goes back to stand-up comedy, and I hope he keeps making films. And if you really want to deep dive into Bo Burnham, just type Bo Burnham into YouTube, and you can see him at age 16 in his first attempts to be an artist. And if you want to check out our online presence, you can go to offcamera.com.
If you haven't checked out our television show version of Off Camera, this is a great place to start. At offcamera.com, you can get our television subscription for only $4.99 a month. And that grants you access to over 165 episodes, all available to watch anytime in HD black and white on any device as many times as you want. It's a great way to deep dive into the show, and it also supports Off Camera. Also, if you're liking this podcast and all of the cockadoodle doing in the background, well, then why don't you take a minute, go to the iTunes site, go to iTunes and subscribe so you can get every episode delivered straight to your phone or other device. And while you're there, take a minute, give us a rating and a review and spread the word about Off Camera. You know, speaking of social media, which we did extensively in this hour with Bo Burnham, I do want to say there are many great uses for social media, and one of them is to get the word about Off Camera out to the world. So if you're liking this show, please tell the world about it. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. You can also reach me directly by email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. And again, if you want to win our impromptu Thanksgiving contest, which I've stolen unabashedly from NPR, well, then identify the place I'm sitting in right now. Like I said, there's roosters cockadoodling, I have a view of some mountains and a bay, the palm trees are swaying, and it rains every day. First one to most specifically identify my vacation location will get a nice off-camera care package. Make sure to send us your snail mail address to receive the package. I want to thank everyone that helps us on this show. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson, who I've enlisted to quiet all these roosters, but I have no idea where he went. Maybe he's sitting by the pool. And before I get into next week's guest, I'm going to share one bad Thanksgiving joke with you. Why did the cranberry sauce cross the road? To get to the other sides. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress Carey Mulligan.
When I did Girls and Boys this year, we got to the last week of rehearsal and I hadn't got through a run-through yet. I couldn't get it out. I was just, my throat was closing up. I was running off to the balcony outside and we were having all these crisis chats. Like, what's the worst thing that would happen if I just bailed on this? I didn't know the words by Sunday night still. I was fucking terrified. But I was like, above everything else, any of the shit that you're doing, you're a mum and you have two kids. So I held my daughter's hand and I held my baby and then stood backstage like that for like 10 seconds and then I walked on to it.
Carey has been on my off-camera wish list since the beginning as an artist that manages to convey humanity in the most nuanced and naturalistic ways. And I was immediately taken by her in 2009's An Education and 2010's Never Let Me Go, two films that established Carey as an actress of great import, a fact which legitimately surprised Carey, who thought her performance in An Education was dull and uninspiring. In my fascinating talk with a woman who is both confident and still prone to bouts of stage fright, Carey discusses her personal journey towards finding work that, in her words, she will eventually tell her grandchildren about. This includes her most recent tour de force performance in Wildlife, in which she plays a messy, flawed woman who dismantles her marriage. The film has created lively discussion about how women are traditionally portrayed in cinema, a discussion that we had a deep dive about. See you next time, Off Camera.